There's an awful lot going on these days over in the Israel-Iran conflict. How might that affect you and your job? Stay tuned. We're going to discuss that right now with an expert. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today, and we're going to take a look at what is essentially, at the time of this recording, current events. I usually try to avoid current events so that we create evergreen episodes, but in this particular case, this could continue to affect us or some derivative of it for weeks and perhaps months and years to come, if not from the conflict we're facing right now, but in general. So I have on our call today Nate Case to discuss some of the issues with regard to cyber in the Israel-Iran conflict. Nate, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much, Jimar. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just great. Tell me a little bit about yourself and a little bit of background. It's really our first meeting here. I was just saying,
it is.
I'm on the show right now, so well, here you are.
Well, and like, let's be clear, I got asked to do this 24 hours ago, so here we go. Hey, I'm Nathan Case. I've spent most of my career doing incident response or cybersecurity at some level or another. I started off by owning a couple of companies that basically helped build and manage data centers. I've seen everything there is to see as far as cyber attacks go, whether it be script kiddies all the way up to nation state actors, and have in many cases had the, I'm going to call it a pleasure, but it's kind of gross, really, when you think about it, defending civilian and government organizations from significant cyber threat.
Interesting. Well, as we know, we've had now for 3.5 years the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that has given us an awful lot of insights in terms of potential tactics, techniques, strategic objectives, and things like that with regard to cyber. And now, within the last week and a half or so, we are also looking at things going on with Iran and Israel. And this is kind of a wondering that I'm looking for is, have there been any lessons learned from what started in 2022 with regard to Russia and Ukraine? Is this being in the similar vein or is this different? Now, if we go back and take a look at the Russia-Ukraine war, which started back in February 2022, it's really been a good insight in terms of how cyber operations can intersect with our conventional warfare. And what I found is that initially we always thought if you trained in cyber warfare, you went to work, for example, Cyber Command, or spend a fortune taking SANS classes, which are really good, by the way, and build up your credentials, that you think cyber is going to be that decisive advantage that is going to go ahead and just obliterate an enemy. They're going to lay down, surrender their arms because they're completely deaf, dumb, and blind with regard to communications, information, etc. But that's not really the case. It hasn't been a game changer. For example, if you go back 10 years to Russian cyber attacks, like the black energy attack on the Ukraine power grid, that's kind of set some pretty high level expectations. Wow, cyber campaigns are going to take out critical infrastructure. We're going to turn off the lights in an entire nation. Yet back in that war, as it's progressed, we've seen a lot more limited impacts. It's great for a tactical goal. You could go ahead and go after logistics. You could do some ransomware. You could spread disinformation. But it really hasn't affected the battlefield decisively as far as we can see. But what we have learned from that conflict is a couple of things. Russia has focused on critical infrastructure. Very early on, Russian malware was found in both U.S. and U.K. infrastructure, which suggested maybe they had broader ambitions if they're going to disrupt support for Ukraine by Western nations. But to a large extent, these efforts didn't pan out. We have robust defenses, mostly with people like you, rapid attribution and things like that. But the other thing is trying to integrate cyber with electronic warfare and SIGIN, or signals intelligence. And Russia calls that strategic operations to destroy critical targets. But yes, when we take a look at the data, it suggests their biggest impact might have just been propaganda, especially in the global south. If you go south of the equator, you'll find out that Russia has pushed very strong anti-Ukraine narratives. If you go to Africa, for example, you'll find out that Russia dominates the communications of that particular aspect of the conflict. And so that's shaping global politics and global perception, not just for governments, but the average person as well. What are your thoughts in terms of anything that Russia-Ukraine might have done to help shape our understanding of cyber?
So I think the first thing that I would step back and look at the whole thing from is that, keep in mind, Black Energy was actually 2007. So it's more than 10 years.
Mea culpa.
Well, no, but I mean, like, we're, we've, yeah. it is long in the past at this point. And so as we sit here today, a couple of old white guys, it is legitimately a long damn time ago. And I mean, I remember working on some of the things that happened back then.
So as we talk about the things that exist today, I think it's important to step back and kind of take a look at what is the impact of cyber. And I don't know, as an American, as our sociological mindset is, we tend to try to find that boom. I want that crater. And if I see that crater, then I know how to respond to that crater in the future. And I begin to deal with some of the things that go on in the world about, you know, hey, this is a problem. We need to fix it. And in many cases, what we're seeing in cyber, and specifically as we talk about ICS, as we talk about the other things in cyber that are, I'm going to call them more life existent altering types of things. We'll talk about water, power, any number of internet types of things. Those things specifically, to say that it's not impactful is interesting, but I don't think that that's really what cyber is looking at right now. When we talk about the way to deal with some of that, what I've seen and what I think others like me have probably started to see is the ability to push into those systems and not necessarily shut them down, but rather hang out and be ready to shut them down in the event that they need to. Now, the reality is in many of these systems, you can't really blow them up. They're not going to cease to exist. And someone like you or I is going to come marching in the door in 20 minutes and we're going to try to fix it. And in most cases we can. The impact of that, however, can indeed be somewhat disruptive. So as we think about how that works in the world around us, if we assume then that the Russians, the Chinese, take your pick of whoever, the Iranians in this case, and they actually have a significant background of doing things like this, is going to be to attack your local water company. There are ways to significantly change the way a water company is able to both clean and distribute water to its populace, and that will significantly injure or potentially kill the people in that area. So it's a little scary, because what we haven't seen is anybody willing to push over that line. And I would tend to argue that that tends to be because of things like the Rome Accords and whatnot, where we actually classify that as a significant crime on humanity. If we think about the Chinese specifically, there's some reports now that they don't have many droppers or things going on inside of hospitals. And so we start to see kind of a switch in the way our general cyber attackers are looking at things. And we're starting to look at it more like actual warfare and correlating the things that we would do in a war to the things that we're willing to do in cyber. And I think that's fair and appropriate, especially to the civilians in the world.
Yeah, and if you look at the Talon Manual, for example, which I saw it in first draft form in 2011, I gave a talk on it in 2012 for the first time. So that goes back, you know, we'll go back a ways on that one. But that laid out, if you will, a mapping of the principles of warfare, things that we agree to, Geneva Convention, et cetera, to cyber. And they came up with 95 different mappings. And what was interesting is you look at things like booby traps are considered to be against the rules of war. You don't want to put a little doll out there, have some little girl pick it up and blow it up. That's just considered wrong. Don't do it. Yet we go ahead and we think of the equivalent of booby traps. What's that? That's an attachment that you click it, open it up, and there's malware in it. Well, it was interesting is at the conclusion of my talk, I said, well, there's all these mappings and things like that. But as of that date, and I think it might still be true today, in spite of kind of the UN convention that was drafted this past year, there are no international agreements on cyber warfare. There's no treaties. There's nothing that said, hey, we agree that this is off limits.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that we look at cyber and we could probably broadly classify it into two different categories. What we're trying to talk about on this show, which is nation state actors. And then this would be the hackers, hacktivists, organized crime, etc. They may essentially use the same tools. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. It's a Venn diagram and they
do. All right.
We'll get that. So let me lay out this premise and we'll go from there. But for example, you might say gun violence in our cities is not caused by the U.S. Army walking around and shooting people. It's criminals walking around and robbing people, but they're still using the same instruments, firearms.
Right.
And so in this particular case, if we look at these categories, now let's discuss that, get your insights on that in terms of, is this Venn diagram like this? Is it a little bit overlap? Are they basically indistinguishable from each other in terms of their goals or techniques and the ways to defend?
So I think to begin with, it's interesting that you mentioned Talon.
One of the people I actually was looking into over the last 24 hours, Tara Wheeler did a keynote at CyberCon, I think 2-3 weeks ago now. And she specifically talked about a lot of this stuff. And so as we look at the concepts that we're talking about right now, I mean, we come into a lot of the, is it appropriate to, is it actually, and it's Rome statutes, not accords, sorry. Rome statutes and Article 7 and 8 that we're specifically talking about here. I think it's interesting that humans decide that they just really want to kill each other all the time. So as we look at this, do 7 and 8 really compare or align with the things that we, as frankly, cyber attackers, we are a nation state. We live in the United States. Sorry, we are as well a nation state. We're just somebody else's nation state. And as we think about that, what are we willing to do? Where are we willing to draw the line? Where are we willing to philosophically say this is a legitimate target of a nation state actor? By nation state actor, for those of you who don't know, we're talking about something like the United States, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, South Korea. We are a nation that has specifically people trained and built to blow things up or kill people. And that's a military organization. No questions asked. And should they be attacking civilians? And to your point specifically, G-Mark, what is an appropriate target?
And if we look at, for example, what's happening today, the generals go to war with their lawyers.
They do.
In cyber. So I remember talking to Joel Brenner, who is the chief legal for NSA. He subsequently published a book, which is quite good. And the name of it escapes me at the moment, but if you look up Joel Brenner, you'll find it. It was there, and it was written from the perspective of somebody that says, hey, the general's sitting there and can look over and says, what authorities do I have? Can I do this under Title 10, Title 50? What's the title that allows me to go ahead and do this? And the Booz Allen consultant there loading up the package would say, sir, please press the enter key, because I don't have the authority to press the enter key, but you have the authority to press the enter key. And so we get to these efforts, as you had said, what's an appropriate target, an inappropriate target, but it's not necessarily the battlefield commander or the corporal out there with an M16 trying to decide, should I not shoot at this person? This is rolling all the way back up. We're almost like a centralized command structure like the old Soviet Union, where we've got to go ahead and get not approval from the Kremlin, but approval from the lawyers before we can go ahead and click launch.
Well, and I think that's part of the problem. I mean, legitimately, we've got some question about what is an appropriate target, because historically, we haven't been able to define who's getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
There's no clinical code right now for Nathan killed someone with a weapon, and consequently, that weapon was a cyber weapon, and so that's going on their death certificate. There's no way to do that right now. Mm-hmm. And because there's no way to do that, I would, as a lawyer, And I'm not one, I only play one on TV, I would tend to argue that, you know, realistically, you can't tell me that the cyber weapon is the thing that killed them. So in The Hague, I'm not going to go to prison because I didn't kill you with a cyber weapon. You died of pneumonia.
Shrug. Yeah. Or if, for example, you had a pacemaker and somebody went ahead and Bluetoothed it. Yeah. And that's good reason perhaps to think carefully about that in a pacemaker. I think a former vice president of the United States asked to make sure his had no wireless connectivity.
And there's that question, like realistically, what happens when we start looking at the grounding of the question that you're asking? And I think there's a philosophic portion of this, a sociologic portion of this, that is, are we as a society okay with attacking civilians? And I would pray to the almighty God himself, if it would help, that we will not as Americans be okay attacking civilians. That's not an okay thing.
Yeah, and if we go back and we look at Clausewitz, who wrote Von Kriege, Art of War, it was required reading when I went to both the Naval War College and Army War College. And you have the triad, or the trinity, whatever you want to call it, which is the military, the government, and the will of the people. And we find out in things such, for example, North Vietnam, was not going to overthrow the United States government. They weren't going to get a regime change. They were not going to be able to defeat the U.S. Army on the battlefield. So they went after the hearts and minds of the American people. And the anti-war movement is eventually what shifted and moved Johnson out of office and Nixon eventually to go ahead and close down the war. So it's a valid approach toward warfare going back 200 years to Clausewitz. But that was an influence operation rather than a warhead-on-forehead operation.
Correct.
We weren't detonating bombs around the country trying to go ahead and get people to say, hate the Vietnam War. In fact, by attacking civilians, as we've probably seen in Ukraine, it tends to firm up the national resolve.
I would
tend
to agree.
Counter to what the original, the attacking party might want to get. Hey, we'll demoralize them. And they say, no, we're we're buckling down because we have an existential threat against our way of life, our culture, our nation, yeah. And we're going to do that. And so let's roll over into Iran, Iraq, and Iran and Israel, and look at some of the things we have going there. So some of the initial impressions that I have read, and again, the problem is I don't have unfiltered intel data coming out there. I don't have a clearance anymore. I'm not in that game. And really, for people who've never had a clearance, like, well, it's all secret stuff. It's like, no, a lot of times you're just protecting the source of the information. If there's somebody boots on ground that documenting what's going on and sending you, the people that they're writing about don't want them to do that. They're going to grab them and take them away. So we're like, yeah, we'll just limit who knows that. So it's nothing magic. There's no dark room with slowly rotating ceiling fans going on. But more to the point is some of the stuff that I have read had said that some of the attacks coming back on Iran in terms of looking at taking out the banking system, for example, has been a significant attack on that. And these are non-military targets, by the way, keeping with...
I tend to agree. And that's the beginning of this discussion for me is really like, I honestly think we need to take a really hard look at the impact of the things we're doing over there. Now, to the question and keeping it in the box appropriately for what is an attack pattern that the Iranians are capable of, or what are the things that Iran's going to do when and if the United States gets involved? And I think that was the original question you asked.
Right. That's the premise. That's why if you're still listening to the episode, we're going to get, let's get to that.
I swear to God, we'll get there. So let's go ahead and open the box and do the things. I think it was, when was the crisis with Iran and the United States that they shot a bunch of missiles at the base just south of Iran? Was that 19? Was that 20?
That might have been 20.
Might have been. We could Google that, get it up at the point if anybody needs that exact date. But give the context, as compared to my first involvement was in 79 when the embassy fell, and as a military officer, like, you guys are going over there. And what we went out through there for that initial involvement. I had a long tour of duty over in the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Gulf.
So I think it was 20. It was either late 19 or 20. And when that happened, I wrote a piece for AWS. I actually was working for AWS at the time as one of their senior security geeks. And it was very much a, look, you need to have done your normative security stuff. Do the hygiene that we tell you to do all the time. And yes, the Iranians are pissed. Yes, they shot missiles at us. Yes, the expectation is that they're going to step up attacks against U.S. assets regardless. They do not care whether it's a military asset or mom and pop pizza shop. They care whether or not it's a U.S. target or not.
Mm-hmm. And that almost harkens back to the great patriotic hacker wars of 2001. So for those, I'm going to go back to a little military history, but in April of 2001, there was an American EP-3 that ended up colliding with a Chinese J-8 off of Hainan Island. And they ended up like, we got to do an emergency landing. And he said, like, call up the Chinese Air Force base. Yeah, we're going to land on your runway. And they're like, no way you Americans are going to land here. And they just threw all the crypto gear up the side of the aircraft. Yeah. And this 28-year-old commander saved his crew by putting them down there. Now, we got the people back pretty quickly. And interesting, in 2001, U.S. and Russia were kind of on a cooperation. So we did get the plane back, but it was a Russian aircraft that flew it back in pieces because the Chinese took everything apart. Take a look at it. Says, okay, yeah, we promised we'd give it back. We just didn't say we'd give it back in one piece. But what had happened subsequently over that summer is prior to that, in China, hacking was considered a capital offense. And not only would they execute you, but they'd bill your family for the cost of the bullet. Just the kind of the last little coup de grace at the end. Now, and they kind of relaxed that. And then, you're Chinese, you hack Americans. Americans, you hack Chinese. And that was 24 years ago, these great patriotic hacker wars, where we were going to head and say, hey, it's not a national effort, but we're kind of look the other way if somebody hacks that way. Are you seeing that then from a prospect, perhaps, of Iran, where it is not necessarily a coordinated nation-state activity that's sanctioned, but rather maybe looking the other way, saying all these independent groups, if you want to go ahead and go after the great Satan, have at it.
All right. So I'm going to split that into two questions.
Okay.
One, are there hacker groups that are non-nation-state hacker groups? Yes. Do they count right now? I'm going to argue no.
Okay.
The reality is that, honestly, at the beginning of Russia's assault into Ukraine, we saw a lot of change in the way that those groups work. And we saw them become very
very polarized to a specific individual, in my opinion, the country that was actually paying them at the time, to a pseudo nation state actor. So in many ways, at this point, are there hacker groups? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Do they have a very politically polarized view? And are they doing things that are, yeah, they absolutely are. So do we have a dude trying to make 20 bucks on the corner? Sure. But he's probably, or she's probably, working toward a specific nation state goal set. So are they a nation state actor? I'm not going to debate at this point. It's a hacker that's attacking you. Shrug. Off you go.
Interesting.
So as we start thinking about some of these things, and we like answer that second question, which is Iran really capable of, do they have a reasonable nation state tool set effectively? I would argue that they do. And I would argue that it's not in Tehran and it's not currently geolocated for all intents and purposes in Iran at all. They're very smart and very good at what they do and consequently are scattered across the globe using all sorts of different things that they have and have the ability to use whenever they want to use it. We as Americans tend to be very much a border-centric sort of a populace. And the realities around some of those borders and some of the things that we tend to see is that, hey, I'm going to go ahead and block all of the IPs from Iran, or I'm going to go ahead and block all the IPs from Russia. And sure, absolutely do that. That makes sense. Is it actually going to do anything? No, not really. If you look at the total attacks, like I think it was in 2024, I want to say it was something to the tune of 45% of the nation state attacks on the United States came from the United States.
VPNing in through VPN exit nodes?
Well, it's things
or compromised machines.
Yeah, it's things like going into some, you know, wherever hosting provider that's got a VPN endpoint. You're acting as if you're in the United States, typically from Florida, typically from US East One and AWS. It's cheap. I can give them a credit card. I'm legitimately a customer. They will kick me off because of a EULA violation, and I don't care. Oh, well.
Yeah. And then also they tend to use contractors like Eminent Pasigrad, which is the hosting company, putting up their information out there. So it's
that's
not
a
just
different question here. That's a really interesting one. That's a unique one. So is that a U.S. asset? Yes, that is technically a U.S. asset. Is it giving succor and aid to an Iranian attack team? Yes, it is. Is that now actually an enemy of the state on U.S. soil? And that's one of those things where I shrug and go, posse comitatus is a thing. I have no idea how to deal with this.
Yeah, and you take a look at that. And then, of course, you have the concept of a fifth column, which is something internal, which is supporting an external. Maybe it's better classified into there. But yeah, the Posse Comitatus Act, for those aren't familiar with, was developed, you know, go back 150 years, where it basically prohibits the U.S. military from doing essentially law enforcement activities in the United States. It's basically to keep the army where it belongs, as compared
to the army, and it keeps the police.
The police. And then you have, you know, the stuff we've been looking at recently, which I'm not going to get into because we don't do politics here. But the idea is that ends up being the legal barrier. And there are situations that say, okay, fine, insurrection, rebellion, et cetera.
But that's to the side. And that's right now, we're not talking about that. We're talking about what happens when we have effectively a foreign agent, a foreign power, in this case, the Iranians, buy a building downtown, put a bunch of servers in it, and use that as an attack jump on.
I mean, does that then become a cyber target?
I was going to say that's an FBI problem. And so now we've got to do all of the coordination between all of the teams, and everybody has to know what's going on. And that's great. And there's a whole bunch of things that are currently going on in the world around us right now to try to figure out how to deal with that more efficiently. Life.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, also, Israel has some significant cyber capabilities.
Israel does have some significant cyber.
We should talk about those as well. And there's some people, if you go back and look at Stalin, hold your enemies close, hold your friends close, your enemies closer, with respect to anybody who recognizes or needs to recognize some significant capabilities that come out of that nation. And many of them get commercialized. These folks work at 8200, start their businesses, and some of them grow very well. But they have an organic capability that is, seems to be quite powerful. I mean, you take a look at the opening salvo that took place against Iran, where pretty much their air defenses and everything got shut down. And as a result, boom, in you go. So in a way, it's a little bit like using a Star Trek analogy. I can lower the shields of my opponent.
I was going to say,
phasers at them. By the time they figure it out,
yeah,
taking hit.
This is the cyber attack that we talked about to begin with, right? This is the cyber effect of the thing that we had talked about. And that's a great example of what happens when you have a coordinated cyber attack with a coordinated physical attack. We have an actual kinetic outcome of a physical attack, of a cyber attack. And so whenever you have a country who's literally always at war because somebody's trying to attack them, I'm not making a political statement, but legitimately they're there and they exist. And consequently, because they exist, they're trying really, really hard to continue to exist. And they are damn good. 8200 is damn good at doing cyber.
And if you think about it, does that represent a potential future strategic goal for other nation states? For example,
God, I hope
United
not.
States. Yeah, well, I know. Does the U.S. feel a need to go ahead and improve cyber command to that level?
Oh, to that point of view, yeah. Let me retract my statement then. Yes, absolutely. Do I want us to have to experience existence like that? That seems awfully harsh. That said, cyber command specifically, do we want to increase the ability to do that? Yeah, absolutely. We want to have a reasonable cyber command that has the ability to operate and impact significant threats to the United States. Absolutely. Every day of the week.
Yeah. And of course, there's two roles there. One is defense. The other one is offense. Most of us in the commercial cyber world, we're focusing on defense. We're not allowed to go ahead and reach out and touch someone. I remember back in the 90s, I worked for a company called Secure Computing. They had Sidewinder firewall. The firewall is strikes back. And basically, if we attacked you, it would blast you back. And they said, yeah, the problem is the bad guys very quickly, let's compromise somebody else and bounce off.
Well,
they get into bystanders.
The problem is what I'm going to do is compromise somebody else and convince somebody else that this person over here is attacking you. And then all of a sudden, our hackback isn't really hackback. It's an attack.
Right. And so that idea was tried almost 28 years ago. And to a certain extent, we threw that away because of the difficulty of attribution. And it's still a real problem today when you talk about difficulty of attribution. You'd mentioned issues such as, I mentioned VPN. You'd mentioned about countries or setting up shop within another country. So, hey, they're downtown on Main Street. You have the AWS, the cloud environment, where you just go ahead with a credit card, legit or stolen or otherwise, spin up an instance, and then off you go. So all these represent a complexity of a cyber warfare battlefield that never existed in the kinetic world. Because you go back 200 years, you got the red and the blue or the gray and the yellow.
And we stood in lines and we killed each other like real men. No, it was idiotic. That's why guerrilla warfare got started. And that's probably kind of why we're in the position we're in right now. We decided that things like... the Rome Statutes, we decided that the Geneva Convention were not helping, really, right? I mean, we started looking at guerrilla warfare, and we started looking at that in Vietnam. You mentioned it yourself, where we started dealing with civilian populations and having significant impact to those populations as we start doing warfare, which is really not good. And so as we progress to what we're talking about now, right, and we think about the impact of what I would call very serious things in and around civilian populace, nobody's being particularly careful and nobody's being particularly concerned about it, even though it's specifically a Title VII or Article VII or Article VIII violation. So how do we begin to target in a way that actually is a target and not just another AWS instance? And I think as we think about that, it gets really funky because especially with the Iranians, one of the things they're really, really good at is sticking an insider into another company. I'm just going to go ahead and sick one of my people in your company. They're going to get hired and off you go. And
with a remote workforce.
Yeah. Well, they'll even send them to country of choice. Yeah. So they'll backstop the human and the human just hangs out and does the thing. And they
don't argue about the salary you offer them. Wow, we got a good deal on this well-qualified person.
Well, yeah, honestly, it's probably a money-making venture in many cases. So as we evaluate that, where does the things that we've talked about at the beginning of this episode come into the Iranian conflict here? And what are the Iranians good at? They're really good at basic threat. They're good at, credential stuffing, all of those things. Sure, they're good at phishing. Yes, absolutely, all of those things. They're not in any way, shape, or form afraid to put a dude or dudette on the ground and actually infiltrate your specific plant, your manufacturing thing, your all of those things. There's a reason in some cases the government asks for U.S. citizens only to do a thing. And this is that reason. It's really gross. It's kind of weird. And it really is not an okay thing. You shouldn't be sending people to do cyber crimes into another country with the intent to harm civilians. That's illegal.
Well, then let's take a look at, if I were to look at, set theory, I have cyber warfare, I have guerrilla warfare. Is this a complete set within the other, or is there cyber that's not really guerrilla, or are they totally unrelated?
I don't know. I mean, that's a really interesting question when you think about it. If I attack if I'm part of the government, right, and I'm a U.S. nation state actor, and somebody tells me to go attack a nuclear power station in China, and I shut the nuclear power station down and a bunch of Chinese people die because they're in a hospital that no longer has power, was that an Article 8 violation?
Yeah, and it comes down to dual use, because if that power plant was powering a military base,
and that's question. That's a legit target.
Valid target.
Yeah, that's a totally valid target. But I, as the attacker, knew that I was hitting both the military base and the hospital. I would argue that that's an Article 8 violation.
And that's the dual use question, and that's the one where you have your lawyer sitting there saying,
exactly. And we're back to the
lawyer says, well, it depends. Legal answer.
Well, and I think we get into some significant sophistry there too. There's any number of things that I've seen recently where it legitimately is a reasonable choice for a defender to hide behind civilians so that they can survive a little longer. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, we have the issue of what we define as human shields in one particular case on the battlefield, but also is there equivalent of a cyber human shield where you might operate within a hospital, for example, but that's your command and control for your botnet that happens to be running off the very poorly defended hospital network. So instead of taking out the hospital with ransomware, oops, your files are encrypted. So yeah, we'll just use your processing power and your connectivity, and we'll do damage to everybody else. And if somebody tries to come back with that very difficult problem of attribution, they say, yeah, it's the hospital doing it. Well, obviously not as somebody who's taking that. So.
Well, I think that's an interesting, let's talk about some TTPs here a little bit maybe then. So when we think about like ransomware is a great question. I've had, God, I don't know how many people approach me this week about ransomware. And the reality is that ransomware is a thing. I'm not saying that it's not. We do want to get your bitcoins. That makes sense. Sure. But what I've seen recently people doing with it is I'm a nation state actor. I'm going to hack your stuff. And then before I leave, so there is no way to do attribution, I'm going to ransomware you. And it's not the normative ransomware in that, hey, I'm going to click on the button and go pay a guy and get my stuff back. That's not what ends up happening. You click on a button, you give the guy money, and it never works again. And so this ability to, as a hacker, go in and do a bunch of long-term living off the land-esque attacks, get a bunch of things, IP, whatever makes you happy in that particular target set. Mm-hmm. And then before you leave, close out with a ransomware attack so they can't even tell that you were there or what you were doing. And it looks like yet just another hospital with a ransomware attack. Honestly, folks, nothing to see here.
Yeah, well, even NotPetya masqueraded as a ransomware attack. We realized very quickly when you look at it, wait a minute, everybody got the same Bitcoin address to make the payment. There's no way for them to sort it out. Therefore, this must be a false flag operation. Because I first thought, there's going to be a bullet administered in Moscow because there's sort of honor among thieves if you're in the ransomware network. Always give the files back when they pay the ransom. Why? Because everybody will keep paying the ransom.
Yeah.
As soon as somebody breaks that little Omerta code, then who knows? People are going to do, hey, it's cheaper to take a risk. We're not going to go ahead if there's a 10% chance of getting your files back. But there's a 90% chance of getting your files back. Well, roll the dice and write the check.
Was it Coinbase's CEO recently, after they had gotten ransomwared, that went online and basically said, look, you guys asked me for $20 million. I tell you what, I'm going to pay some $20 million to point you out in the street.
Yeah.
And then I love that. I love this reality of like, seriously, go tell CyberCom and we will come talk to you.
Yeah. And that's interesting because as we're looking at the militarization of cyberspace, if I could use that as a terminology, but the militarization can exist beyond that of just simply government. So we think about armies and the like, and the military is given a legal monopoly on violence. if you think about it, definition. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. They can subcontract, but yes.
I can subcontract it out, but essentially, if somebody invades you, if you're going to invade somebody and you're an army, you said, okay, then we've authorized that, as compared to John Candy going across Lake Erie trying to invade Canada or something like that.
He just wouldn't
work there. Yeah. Yeah. And you got to have it in both languages too. But the idea here is that, are we blurring those distinctions from the kinetic world, where it was pretty easy to identify a combatant versus a non-combatant? In fact, there were different rules. If you are in uniform and you surrender, then you get protections. But if you're not in uniform, or if you're in a militia that has no particular head, and this is going back to the rules of warfare, or something like Anonymous, where they say, hey, there is no head,
you don't
get those protections of war. Yeah. And if you're wearing the uniform of your opponent, well, we can hang you because you're a spy. And they're like, yep, that's it. You put on somebody else's uniform and you get captured. Game over. We can't really plead the book for you on that one. But as we get into cyber, as we remove and fuzz out those differences between nation-state actors and non-nation-state actors, because they're using the same tactics, techniques, and procedures, maybe to a different level of skill and expertise, what do we conclude going forward over the next few years? Is it just it's going to be a dangerous neighborhood and you're never going to be able to do anything other than look over your shoulder or what?
So that's actually one of the things I'm doing right now is I worked for a company called Clarity Innovations. One of the things we do is defensive cyber operations. Mm-hmm. So doing that type of a thing for basically a bunch of us that are both defense, I've done both cyber defense and cyber offense in my career. And as we look at people who are used to understanding what being malicious looks like as a business, and taking that back to doing defense as a business and helping people like hospitals, like mom and pops, that's why I'm spinning the company up. Clarity exists before this, but that's why we're spinning up specifically the DCO portion of this, that is that defensive cyber operation, so that we can take a step back and say, hey, look, we actually know how to do this. We've done it for a number of things already, and we've actually been on the other side of the line. So let us help you figure out how to easily defend yourself. 9 times out of 10, it's not even that hard. It's doing a lot of those hygiene things that we talked way about at the beginning of the episode. But as we think about the things around us right now, it's not even, I mean, I can tell just by the way you're talking about it, it feels like you're thinking about a laptop. It feels like you're thinking about a server. It feels like you're thinking about an ICS system in a power station. But I can tell you right now that I was on an incident about 4 weeks ago that dealt with a guy using his cell phone. I'm not going to tell you, it was kind of gross what he was looking for in his cell phone, but he had ended up using the dark web. The dark web had basically, he had gotten what everyone gets on the dark web, gotten malware, and carried that back into a power generation facility. And because he carried that back into a power generation facility, what ended up happening was they were able to control the power generation facility from this guy's phone because the power generation facility hadn't been set up in an appropriate way. Mm-hmm. So now we're not even thinking about all your laptops. We're thinking about the 8.7 billion devices that exist around us that are just these freaky little mobile things. And so then we pair that back to the Iranian conflict here. And we look at how that actually works and we try to understand what the impact is. As business people, as we talk about the Israeli-Iranian conflict, as we talk about all of these things, what's going to happen when the U.S., if the U.S. gets involved in that conflict directly? I have every expectation that Iranians from around the globe will begin to attack U.S. assets, just like they did in 20 when there was a missile attack and all sorts of crazy things happened then. It's what we saw then. It's what we're going to see now. What should you do? I honestly think you should do everything from the hygiene things that you've been told repeatedly that you're supposed to do. Yes, go get MFA, goddammit. All of the things that go along with that. There's a reason that we tell you to do that. Please go do that. That's the most important thing you can do. And it's also probably the easiest thing for you to do. If you don't know how to do that, find somebody like me. We will happily help you to do that. In many cases, we'll help you to do that for free, so we don't have to help you later. As you think about the things beyond that, though, you need to think about the architectural stuffs that are your technical assets. Do you have them segmented appropriately? Have you set things up to see, detect, understand if someone's in that network? And if you haven't, you're in a bad way. And we need to start talking quickly about how to get you into a position that is a more secure position.
So I think what we're getting to now in the last 5 minutes or so of our episode are prescriptive actions that entities can take. You mentioned MFA. Absolutely, by all means, MFA everywhere. It should be, it's table stakes now, just to be able to get into the game, because the password, the phishing, just the recent email that came out said, what, 16 billion passwords have just been dumped out onto the dark web or things.
Or the SMS attack.
Or the humans.
Yeah, well, or the SMS attack. It really isn't your CEO asking you for Nordstrom's gift cards. Please don't send them. But
Yet people fall for it. And we had a young man who actually did that, went out and bought some gift cards. It was a credit card company that shut him down.
Yep.
Because they said, why do you keep buying these $100 or whatever purchase over and over again? Something's a little bit fishy, if you will, with that. So education of your people and helping them understand where the threat vectors are and what's, this is a sanity check on things such as that. As you get into the world of, you know, deep fakes, it's a whole different episode there about how do you protect against that. I just tell people, I said, have something that only you and I would know, so that if somebody gets compromised, they can say, okay, here's a challenge, give me the response. And it's not anywhere out there on the internet.
Right.
It's going to be something that's just based on personal experience. If they can't do that, yep, declare that has been a violation and off you go. But beyond MFA, segmenting your networks, as you'd mentioned, other ideas, recommendations that you have.
So one of the things that we think we will see from the Iranians, just because of just historical reference and whatnot, is the targeting of ICS and critical infrastructure.
Okay.
If you are a manufacturer and you have an MQTT server that is online, if you are critical infrastructure, if you are power, water, treatment, sewage, take your pick of all of the things that are critical infrastructure. If you have your stuff plugged into LoRaWAN, if you have your stuff plugged into the internets, if you have your stuff set up so that you can go to Shodan and find your stuff, please unplug it.
Yeah, get a Shodan subscription and don't wait until Black Friday when it's only $5. Pay the extra money now.
Pay the $250 now. Check your stuff. And then honestly, unplug it. And I get that the manufacturers are pissed about that. And I've had lots of conversations, and Biohacking Village at DEF CON is coming up. And Nina will be happy to talk to you about the realities of all of the things that go along with my ICS. Hell, you've got ICS Village as well. Bryson will be happy to talk to you about it. Unplug your stuff. Unplug your stuff so that bad people can't get in and turn it off for you, or make it worse than turned off. And try to be
and I would rather
worse than turned off.
80% capacity than zero.
Exactly. And I get it. There are totally reasons to leave it plugged in. And there are manufacturers that bitch and moan about this stuff. And I get it. There's a moment to like literally have a discussion with your manufacturer of this isn't okay.
Yeah. And so being able to do that, taking advantage of, you know, using some of the standards that are out there, whether it's the Australian 8 or the critical controls, the 18 that we have remaining, some sort of framework, if you're in the DoD, the Defense Industrial Base, 800-171 gives you an awful, well, you're going to have to comply with that. But
I was going to say that is kind of table stakes, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot out there. You're not left on your own to defend it, but recognize that it is a hazardous environment. It's already gone high order in at least four different nation states.
Yeah.
Quite possible that it could come ashore out for reasons that are above our pay grade, so to speak. But it doesn't hurt to be prepared. Just like if you live in Florida, don't wait till the hurricane is said, hey, it's 2 days out before you decide to go down to Lowe's and buy some plywood. It's all gone.
Yeah.
Make sure you plan ahead and things like that. Final words before we wrap up.
I think the last one to talk about is supply chain attacks. Honestly, as we think about the things that the easy ways to get into things, Datadog did an excellent job of evaluating different libraries that had been pwned that get included in all sorts of other software. There's lots of things out there like that. I get that it's a pain in the butt. I get that doing software security is not everybody's first thing. There's a number of folks that do really good work in this. All of that said, supply chain is probably the hardest thing for us to evaluate long term. Not going to deny that. It needs to be a program. You need to actually pay for it. It needs to be on your budget line. Do MFA first. Do things like evaluation of your ICS systems. Do an evaluation of your internal people. Figure out where your internal threats are actually coming from, if you have them, where they, all of the things. I'm not looking for a witch hunt here. I'm not looking to play, you know, any of the scary things here. But I am going to point out that you need to understand who your people are and what they're doing. Talk to them. Figure it out. It's not hard. It doesn't need to be crazy, but it does need to be thought through. And then finally, software supply chain stuff does need to be evaluated. You need to understand what's going on like that.
ChainGuard's really good. Datadog's really good. There's a lot of companies out there that do really amazing work that you should probably look into.
And that sounds like a really great way to wrap up the show. So, Nate Case, thank you very much for being part of CISO Tradecraft. For our watchers and listeners, if you're not subscribing, please do so. Give us a 5-star or thumbs up if you can to make sure that other people can find us a little bit easier. And don't forget, we have a Substack newsletter as well if you'd like to see this in print form. This is your host, G. Mark Hardy. Thank you for being part of our show. Thank you again, Nate, for being part of our show as well. And until next time, stay safe out there.